it's not fair story, as I recognize that holding on to it doesn't help me. That doesn't get rid of my envy, but it does help me to get out of the smog. I also find it helpful to remember the following. Usually those people who seem naturally talented have already done a lot more practice than we have in order to get to where they are. For example, Tiger Woods started playing golf at the age of 2, and Mozart started playing the keyboard at the age of 4. Sure, they had natural talent compared to other kids their age, but by the time they started showing phenomenal results in adulthood, they had put in an astonishing amount of practice. For a more down-to-earth example, consider those folks who are socially very confident. The life's blood of every social event, they were not born with the so-called gift of gab. Like you and me, they were born unable to speak, and it took plenty of practice to get them where they are now. Of course, most of them didn't consciously decide, I'm going to practice my conversational skills. More than likely, they developed their skills spontaneously through doing what gave them fulfillment. And while they may well have had a natural talent for social interaction, this doesn't alter the fact that improvement requires practice. So if you want to get good at making conversation, but you can never think of anything interesting to say, and you're not much of a storyteller, then you're going to have to practice telling anecdotes in an engaging manner. If you want to get good at writing thrillers, then you'll need to practice developing plots and characters, writing snappy dialogue, and setting up tension and conflict. If you want to serve well in tennis, well, you get the picture. I could fill a whole book with variants on this sentence, but it'd get a bit tedious. So why not fill in the blanks for yourself? If I want to get good at blank, then I'll need to practice blank. Once you've identified an important skill to practice, the next step, you guessed it, is to do it mindfully. In other words, specifically turn this practice into an opportunity to develop diffusion and engagement. If you're stretching before a training session, do those stretches mindfully. If you're rehearsing your answers for an interview, say them mindfully. If you're doing a warm-up on your instrument, play those scales mindfully. There are at least 3 significant benefits from doing this. The first big benefit is that mindfulness is the antidote to boredom. A common reason we give for not practicing is that it's boring. However, if we are experiencing boredom, that means we have disengaged from what we are doing. Instead, we have fused with a story that the activity is dull or tedious, and that there are other, far more interesting things that we could be doing. But if we unhook ourselves from this story and engage fully in the activity, there is no boredom. Boredom and mindfulness can't occur simultaneously. Mindfulness involves paying attention to what is happening with openness and curiosity. Boredom involves inattention to what is happening and a lack of curiosity. So to enhance your ability to engage, cultivate curiosity about what you are doing. Even if you have done it a million times before, no 2 sessions are ever identical. What can you notice that's different, or that you've previously taken for granted? The second big benefit is that whatever skill you practice, you will get much better results if you do it mindfully than if you go through the motions on autopilot. Remember, step 2 of the confidence cycle is applying skills effectively. This is not possible unless we pay attention to what we are doing. If we want to play tennis well, then we spotlight the tennis ball. If we want to drive a car well, we spotlight the road and the traffic. If we want to socialize well, we spotlight the words and body language of the other person. The third big benefit is that this approach paves the way for peak performance. If you want to perform at your best in any given role, in business, or as a parent, partner, athlete, performer, artist, or lover, then you'll need to have not only good skills, but the ability to remain focused on and engaged in what you're doing. So make a commitment now. What essential skills will you start practicing mindfully? How much will you practice them? Specify when, where, and for how long. And please, don't take my word about the benefits. Try it for yourself and see the difference it makes. What if my skills are good enough? There may well be no problem with your skill levels. For example, research shows that most people with significant social anxiety do not actually lack social skills. They're just fused with stories about being dull, boring, or unlikable, or saying something stupid, boring, or unfunny. Similarly, people who suffer from imposter syndrome have no actual deficit in their skills. They're just fused with the story that they're a fake, fraud, or imposter. However, even if this is the case, there's always room for improving important skills. As Tiger Woods put it, no matter how good you get, you can always get better, and that's the exciting part. So please do choose at least one important skill and commit to doing it mindfully as suggested above. How much mindfulness are you practicing? Here's my prediction. By this point in the book, many readers will be enthusiastically practicing their mindfulness skills and reaping the rewards. However, many others will be reading the book but not actually practicing the exercises because they're repeatedly getting hooked by thoughts such as, "It's all too hard, I'll start it later, I don't have the energy, I can't be bothered, I shouldn't have to do this," and a myriad of other forms of reason-giving. Therefore, in the next section of the book, we're going to look at self-motivation, an essential skill for winning the game of confidence. Part 3. What gets you going? Chapter 11. Fueling up. During my lifetime, I've dedicated myself to this struggle of the African people. I've fought against white domination and I've fought against black domination. I've cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. Nelson Mandela. The above quote is Mandela's closing statement from the infamous Rivonia trial. The South African government had high expectations for the trial. They wanted to impose the death sentence on Mandela and other leaders of the democracy movement. However, due to international protests and sanctions against South Africa, they relented and imposed harsh prison sentences instead. Mandela's values come shining through in his speech: democracy, freedom, equality, and cooperation. Those values kept him going through thick and thin, through establishing a legal firm to provide free or low-cost legal support for poor black people, throughout the many years he spent underground, hiding from the police while inciting non-violent resistance against the government, throughout his 27 grueling years of imprisonment, and during his term as the first democratically elected president of South Africa. And any time he felt frightened, demoralized, or exhausted, those values gave him the strength to persevere. In prison, Mandela realized that the government could take away his freedom, but they couldn't take away his values. He believed that good education was essential for democracy and equality, and he was determined to make it available for one and all. So he established an underground university. Prisoners would secretly meet in the mineshafts to discuss ideas, share knowledge, attend lectures, and teach each other everything from politics to Shakespeare. Later, this became known as Nelson Mandela University. He also studied Afrikaans, the language of white South Africans, and took every opportunity to discuss South African politics and history with the white warders. This gave him great insight into the attitudes and belief systems of the white Boer minority, which later became invaluable when he had to negotiate a new South African constitution. And in his later years in prison, when his conditions were a bit better, he even completed a law degree by correspondence. So what has all this to do with confidence? To answer that question, we need to revisit values and goals. Values and goals revisited. Most books and courses on self-development place a major focus on goal setting, especially when they cover topics such as confidence, success, and peak performance. And rightly so, because goals are important. However, if we want the best chance of achieving our goals, we'd do well to clarify our values first. Why? For at least three reasons. One, values give us the inspiration and motivation to persist, to do what needs to be done, even when the going gets rough. If our goals are a long way off, or very difficult, or there are major obstacles in the way, then without values to keep us motivated, we'll often run out of steam before we get there. Mandela's values sustained him throughout a lifetime of fear, anguish, and heartbreak. Without them, he would never have achieved what he did. Two, values give us guidance. Values are like a compass. They guide our journeys, give us direction, and keep us on track. If we pursue goals that are not aligned with our core values, it almost always leads to disappointment and dissatisfaction. But if we use our values to set personally meaningful goals, the opposite holds true. Three, values provide us with fulfillment as we move toward our goals. In his early adulthood, Mandela set himself a seemingly impossible goal: to get rid of apartheid and establish South Africa as a democracy. It took him decades before he finally achieved that goal, but he was able to find fulfillment along the way through continuously living by his values. With every step he took toward his goal, he knew he was standing for something, that he was doing something meaningful with his life, and that gave him fulfillment and satisfaction. As Mandela writes in his autobiography, there are victories whose glory lies in the fact that they are only known to those who win them. This is particularly true of prison, where you must find consolation in being true to your ideals, even if no one else knows of it. Values and the P word. One of the most common themes in this book is practice. I've pointed out several times that we can't expect to feel confident in any activity until we have developed the necessary skills. And we can't develop those skills unless we practice. We also need to develop a capacity for mindfulness so that we can engage fully in whatever we are doing and defuse from unhelpful thought processes such as worrying, perfectionism, and self-doubt. And obviously, this also requires practice. Unfortunately, it is much easier to talk about practice than to do it. Why? Because practice brings up uncomfortable thoughts and feelings. Even thinking about it often makes us uncomfortable, and human beings do not like feeling uncomfortable. So what do we tend to do? To avoid the discomfort, we don't do the practice. We either put it off until later, or we come up with reasons why we can't do it. It's only natural that we do this. After all, in that moment when we decide to put it off or skip it, we usually get an instant feeling of relief. All those uncomfortable thoughts and feelings disappear. And that feels good, right? And everybody likes to feel good. But here's the problem. Because we all like to have good feelings, we do what we can to avoid or get rid of unpleasant ones. And this all too easily becomes a habit. And then we start making unworkable choices. We do what gives us least discomfort in the short term rather than what gives us most fulfillment in the long term. Psychologists have a fancy term for this phenomenon. They call it experiential avoidance. Experiential avoidance means trying hard to avoid or get rid of unwanted thoughts and feelings. Now, we are all experientially avoidant to some degree. I don't know anyone who loves having unpleasant thoughts and feelings and never tries to avoid or get rid of them. But the more unwilling we are to make room for discomfort, the lower our quality of life. Indeed, high levels of experiential avoidance directly correlate with reduced performance, increased stress, and higher risk of depression and anxiety. Why should this be so? Because the more we try to avoid discomfort, the more we base our actions on how we feel rather than on what is most important in life. In other words, we avoid doing things that are important and life-enhancing because we are unwilling to make room for the uncomfortable thoughts and feelings that show up. And the more we choose action that gives us short-term relief from discomfort rather than doing what enriches our lives in the long term, the smaller and emptier our lives tend to become. We often call this living in the comfort zone. Here's a simple example of experiential avoidance. In reading this book, have you skipped any of the exercises? If so, why did you do that? Your mind might well have tried to justify this choice by saying the exercise wasn't important or that you'll do it later. But isn't it the case that when you considered doing it, you felt some discomfort? And when you chose to skip it, you felt some relief? If so, experiential avoidance has been dictating your choices. And for most of us, this happens on a regular basis. When we put off or opt out of important goals and challenges, chances are that we're not being true to ourselves. We're not behaving like the person we really want to be. We're not making choices in line with our long-term best interests. So how do we get past this? How do we get ourselves to do the practice? Do we read a Nike poster and then just do it? Do we ask the universe to make it easy for us? Do we vividly imagine all our dreams coming true? Do we try to reprogram our minds with positive thinking? These are all popular approaches, and you can be the judge of whether they work or not. What I can tell you is this. By the time they come to see me, most of my clients have tried these things and found they are not sustainable in the long term. So what is sustainable? What can get us going and keep us going even when we're tired, miserable, anxious, bored, frustrated, fearful, or not in the mood? What can motivate us to step out of our comfort zones into challenging situations that are guaranteed to bring up fear and anxiety? You guessed it. Our values. The inner compass. As mentioned in Chapter 1, our values are like a compass. They give us direction, guide our journey, and help us stay on track. Our goals are things we want to accomplish along the way, to cross this river, climb that mountain, visit that castle, or ski down that slope. So suppose climbing Mount Everest is your goal. The values underlying it might be the following: courage, persistence, focus, doing your personal best, exercising and fitness, personal growth, connecting with nature, exploring, and adventure. Notice we could set a number of different goals guided by these values. Climbing Everest is literally only one among millions. Now, obviously you can't climb Everest alone. You have to be part of a team. So there's another set of values to consider. What sort of teammate do you want to be? For example, do you want to be open-minded, flexible, considerate, friendly, helpful, respectful, reliable, loyal, honest, responsible, and so on? Notice that in both examples above, you can live by those values every step of the way toward your goals. And even if you never accomplish the goals of forming a team or climbing Mount Everest, you can still live by those underlying values: courage, persistence, personal growth, open-mindedness, flexibility, responsibility, and so on, and find plenty of fulfillment in doing so. Of course, you'd feel disappointed if you didn't achieve your goals, but at least you'd have the satisfaction of knowing you'd been true to yourself, lived by your ideals, and behaved like the sort of person you want to be. In Chapter 1, I asked you to consider how you would change if you developed genuine confidence, what goals you would set, what actions you would take, and how you would behave differently on an ongoing basis. In the next few chapters, we'll be revisiting these questions. Your answers are vitally important because until now, you've probably been stuck in the confidence gap, waiting until the day you feel confident before you start doing what really matters to you. And we've seen how that's a recipe for discontent. Our lives get put on hold, and we miss out on all sorts of opportunities. To win the game of confidence, we must play by the golden rule. Rule 1. The actions of confidence come first, the feelings of confidence come later. So here's where we're heading in the next few chapters. First, you'll clarify your values and goals and make sure that they're in sync, that your goals are aligned with your values. Then you'll break those goals down into actions. Next, you'll start taking those actions mindfully, engaging fully in what you do and unhooking yourself from unhelpful stories. As you do this, you will be acting with confidence, relying on yourself and trusting yourself to do what really matters. Finally, as you get better at what you do and better at diffusing from self-doubt and perfectionism, you are likely to notice the feelings of confidence appear. Now, at some point in the process, you'll almost certainly get stuck. Feelings of fear and anxiety will arise, and you are highly likely to struggle with them. Fortunately, that's not a problem. Once you realize what has happened, you can use the mindfulness skill called expansion to stop struggling with your feelings and handle them more effectively. That's what part four of this book is about. But given that we've only just started part three, let's take a quick look at your values. There are many different ways to clarify our core values, and the exercise below was inspired by a similar one in the book Curious by Todd Kashdan. Below you'll find a list of common values, not all of which will be relevant to you. Keep in mind there is no such thing as a right or wrong value. It's a bit like our taste in pizzas. If you prefer ham and pineapple, but I prefer salami and olives, that doesn't mean that my taste in pizzas is right and yours is wrong. It just means we have different tastes. And similarly, we may have different values. So read through the list below and rate each value according to its importance to you. Make sure to score at least 10 of them as very important. If you don't want to write in the book, you can download a PDF from the free resources page on www.thehappinesstrap.com. As you do this exercise, notice what your mind does. For example, if you score a value as very important, but you are currently behaving inconsistently with that value, your mind is likely to beat you up or say, "Who are you kidding?" Common values. There is no such thing as a right or wrong value. This list is merely to get you thinking about what your own values are. Mark each value as V, Q, or N, where V equals very important, Q equals quite important, and N equals not so important. 1. Acceptance, to be open to and accepting of myself, others, life, and so on. 2. Adventure, to be adventurous, to actively seek, create, or explore novel or stimulating experiences. 3. Assertiveness, to respectfully stand up for my rights and request what I want. 4. Authenticity, to be genuine and real, to be true to myself. 5. Beauty, to appreciate, create, nurture, or cultivate beauty in myself, others, the environment, and so on. 6. Caring, to be caring toward myself, others, the environment, and so on. 7. Challenge, to keep challenging myself to grow, learn, and improve. 8. Compassion, to act with kindness toward those who are suffering. 9. Conformity, to be respectful and obedient of rules and obligations. 10. Connection, to engage fully in whatever I am doing and be fully present with others. 11. Contribution, to help or make a positive difference to myself or others. 12. Cooperation, to cooperate and collaborate with others. 13. Courage, to be brave, to persist in the face of fear, threat, or difficulty. 14. Creativity, to be creative or innovative. 15. Curiosity, to be open-minded and interested, to explore and discover. 16. Encouragement, to reward behavior that I value in myself or others. 17. Equality, to treat others as equal to myself and vice versa. 18. Excitement, to seek, create, and engage in activities that are exciting, stimulating, or thrilling. 19. Fairness, to be fair to myself and others. 20. Fitness, to maintain or improve my fitness, to look after my physical and mental health and well-being. 21. Flexibility, to adjust and adapt readily to changing circumstances. 22. Forgiveness, to be forgiving toward myself and others. 23. Freedom, to live freely, to choose how I live and behave, and to help others do likewise. 24. Friendliness, to be friendly, companionable, or agreeable toward others. 25. Fun, to seek, create, and engage in fun-filled activities. 26. Generosity, to be sharing and giving to both myself and others. 27. Gratitude, to be grateful for and appreciative of the positive aspects of myself, others, and life in general. 28. Honesty, to be honest, truthful, and sincere with myself and others. 29. Humility, to be humble or modest, to let my achievements speak for themselves. 30. Humor, to see and appreciate the humorous side of life. 31. Independence, to support myself and choose my own way of doing things. 32. Industry, to be industrious, hardworking, dedicated. 33, intimacy, to open up, reveal, and share myself emotionally or physically in my close personal relationships. 34, justice, to uphold justice and fairness. 35, kindness, to be kind, compassionate, considerate, nurturing, or caring toward myself or others. 36, love, to act lovingly or affectionately toward myself or others. 37, mindfulness, to be conscious of, open to, and curious about my here and now experience. 38, open-mindedness, to think things through, see things from others' points of view, and weigh evidence fairly. 39, order, to be orderly and organized. 40, patience, to wait calmly and tolerantly for what I want. 41, persistence, to continue resolutely despite problems or difficulties. 42, pleasure, to create and give pleasure to myself or others. 43, power, to strongly influence or wield authority over others, to take charge, lead, and organize. 44, reciprocity, to build relationships in which there is a fair balance of giving and taking. 45, respect, to be respectful toward myself and others, to be polite, considerate, and show positive regard. 46, responsibility, to be responsible and accountable for my actions. 47, romance, to be romantic, to display and express love or strong affection. 48, safety, to secure, protect, or ensure the safety of myself or others. 49, self-awareness, to be aware of my own thoughts, feelings, and actions. 50, self-care, to look after my health and well-being and get my needs met. 51, self-development, to keep growing, advancing, or improving in knowledge, skills, character, or life experience. 52, self-control, to act in accordance with my own ideals. 53, sensuality, to create, explore, and enjoy experiences that stimulate the five senses. 54, sexuality, to explore or express my sexuality. 55, spirituality, to connect with things bigger than myself. 56, skillfulness, to continually practice and improve my skills and apply myself fully when using them. 57, supportiveness, to be supportive, helpful, encouraging, and available to myself or others. 58, trust, to be trustworthy, to be loyal, faithful, sincere, and reliable. 59, insert your own unlisted value here. Once you've marked each value as V, Q, N, very important, quite important, or not so important, go through all the Vs and select out the top six that are most important to you. Mark each one with a six to show it's in your top six. So what did that exercise reveal about the sort of person you want to be, the way you want to treat others and yourself, and what you want to stand for in life? If you haven't done the exercise yet, what stopped you? Did you get hooked by do it later or can't be bothered? Or did an unpleasant feeling show up that you wanted to get rid of? Are you willing to go back and do it now, even though you may feel uncomfortable and your mind's just given you some seemingly valid reasons not to do it? Very commonly, when we do this exercise, we discover significant gaps between our values and our actions. For example, Seb, the taxi driver who was avoiding sex with his wife, listed one of his top values as intimacy. Clearly, there was a huge discrepancy between this core value and the way he was behaving toward his wife. The same was true for Claire, the shy receptionist who hadn't dated for years. One of her top values was authenticity, but she rarely allowed people to see the real her because she was afraid of rejection. Similarly, in Chapter 1, I introduced Alexis, a 28-year-old mother of two young boys, who said she would like to be more assertive with her domineering, hypocritical mother-in-law. One of her core values was courage, and she did indeed act on this value in many areas of her life. For example, Alexis was a nurse, and before becoming a full-time mum, she had travelled the world widely and worked in field hospitals in war-torn parts of Africa. But when it came to standing up to her overbearing mother-in-law, she lost touch with her courage and shrank from the challenge. When you find a gap between your values and your behaviour, there's no need to beat yourself up. This is simply a reminder that you are a normal human being, not a fictitious superhero. No one acts on their values all the time in every domain of life, and it's unrealistic to expect to do so. Sure, we can all get better at acting on our values, but we'll never be perfect. And keep in mind, the more destructive or self-defeating our behavior, the more likely it is that we are acting inconsistently with our core values. For example, last night I had a huge argument with my wife. I lost my temper and said some really hurtful things to her. In that moment, my behavior was both destructive and self-defeating. It was destructive to our relationship and self-defeating in that it didn't help me to get the outcome I wanted. Was I acting on my core values during that argument? No way. I was acting totally inconsistently with three of my top six values: caring, connection, and contribution. Of course, once I calmed down, I reconnected with those values, promptly apologized, and we made up. Now I invite you to do another quick exercise. Put this book down, grab a piece of paper, and write down those very important top six values. For the next few months, carry them around in your wallet or purse and pull them out frequently to reflect on them. The more you are in touch with your core values, the more you can draw on them for inspiration and guidance. An important message. Please be careful that you don't turn your values into rigid rules such as, "I have to be courageous at all times." If your mind's using words like should, have to, must, ought, right, or wrong, then it's not reminding you of values, it's dictating the law. There's a huge difference between values and rules. For example, thou shalt not kill is not a value, it's a rigid rule, a commandment, no less. When we were children, the adults in our lives told us that if we follow this rule, we're good, and if we don't, we're bad. But the values underlying this rigid rule are caring for and respecting human life. And there are many different ways to act on these values. Please note, I am not suggesting for a moment that it's okay to break this rule. I am merely drawing the distinction between rules and values. Psychologist John Forsyth compares our values to a cube that constantly shifts position. No matter what the position, you can never see all of the faces of the cube simultaneously. Some will be at the front and others at the back. But the faces you can't see haven't ceased to exist, they're just not in the foreground. Similarly, in any given moment, some values are prominent and others aren't. The values that we're not acting on haven't disappeared, it's just that in that moment they're not a priority. As we go through life, our rules about how to act on our values change dramatically, but the values themselves often don't change all that much. For example, ask a 6-year-old boy how he would like to treat a little puppy dog, and he's likely to talk about feeding it, cuddling it, and playing with it. What he's really talking about are the values of caring and nurturing. By the time that little boy becomes a 36-year-old father of two children, he will have all sorts of sophisticated rules about how to look after his kids: bedtime routines, the best ways of encouraging them, rules about acceptable behavior, and so on. But the core values of caring and nurturing are the same. The relative importance we place on our values usually changes enormously throughout our lives. For example, protecting your children is likely to be a top priority value when they are young, vulnerable, and defenseless. But by the time they are middle-aged with families of their own, this value, while it won't have disappeared, is likely to be somewhat less prominent. This means that if you return to the exercise above in a year's time, you may find that some of the values you marked as not important have shifted to quite important or very important, and vice versa. And your top six list may have altered dramatically. On the other hand, it may not change much at all. Everyone's experience is unique. A word of warning: watch out for perfectionist hooks such as, "I have to live by my values at all times." You don't have to do any such thing. Values are simply words that express the way you ideally want to behave. You don't have to act on them. It's a personal choice. In ACT, we encourage you to use your values as a guide, because this generally leads to fulfillment and vitality. But we wouldn't want you to turn them into a set of rigid rules for controlling your life. Steve Hayes, the creator of ACT, has a good way of saying this, which gives us the fifth rule of the confidence game. Rule 5. Hold your values lightly, but pursue them vigorously. If we follow this rule flexibly and mindfully, as opposed to rigidly and automatically, it will allow us to escape from... Chapter 12, The Success Trap. What does the word success mean to you? When you hear, she is very successful, or he's made a success of himself, what does that conjure up for you? Our society generally defines success in terms of achieving goals, fame, wealth, status, and respect, a big house, a luxury car, a prestigious job, a huge salary. When people achieve these things, our society tends to label them successful. But if we buy into this popular notion of success, we set ourselves up for a lot of unnecessary suffering. How so? Well, this view of success inevitably pulls us into the goal-focused life, where we are always striving to achieve the next goal. We may strive for more money, a larger house, a better neighborhood, smarter clothes, a slimmer body, bigger muscles, more status, more fame, more respect, and so on. We may strive to win this game, or tournament, or make that sale, or get that promotion, or win that contract, or find a more attractive partner, or buy that smart car, or get that qualification, or earn that university degree. And the illusion is, when I achieve this goal, then I will be successful. There are at least three big problems associated with going through life this way. First, there's no guarantee you will achieve those goals, or they may be a long way off, which leads to chronic frustration and disappointment. Second, even if you do achieve them, they will not give you lasting happiness. Usually, they give you a brief moment of pleasure, satisfaction, or joy, and then you start to focus on the next goal. Third, if you buy into this notion of success, it will put you under tremendous pressure, because you have to keep on achieving and achieving to maintain it. As long as you can keep achieving those goals, then you are successful, a winner, a high achiever, a champion. But if you stop achieving, then you are no longer successful. You are a has-been, a failure, or a loser. It is this popular notion of success that creates the commonplace problem of fragile self-esteem. Fragile self-esteem is very common in high-performing professionals. These high achievers often develop a strong, positive self-image based on their performance. As long as they perform well and have high self-esteem, but as soon as their performance drops, their self-esteem comes tumbling down, from winner to loser, from high achiever to failure. If we live our lives ruled by this definition of success, we are doomed to stress and misery, punctuated by brief moments of joy when we achieve a goal. So I invite you to consider a radically different definition. True success is living by your values. This definition makes our lives ever so much easier. Why? Because in any moment we can act on our values. Yes, even if we've neglected them for years. Presto, instant success. This concept is especially useful if your goals are a long way off. You don't have to wait until you've achieved them. You can be successful right now through living by your values. Suppose you want to change your career and become a cardiac surgeon. You're looking at a minimum of 10 years before you can achieve this goal. That's a long time. But suppose the core value underlying that goal is helping others. You can successfully act on that value over and over, all day, every day, for the rest of your life, even if you never become a cardiac surgeon. Consider this quote from Martin Luther King, Jr. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. This comes from his famous speech delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Washington, D.C., to a crowd of 200,000 civil rights protesters on August 28, 1963. By the popular notion of success equals achieving your goals, Martin Luther King was not successful. He did not achieve his goal of equal rights for people of all skin colors. And yet, we remember, admire, and respect him. Why? Because he stood for something. He lived by his values. When living by our values becomes the definition of success, it means we can be successful right now. All we need to do is act on our values. From this perspective, the mother who gives up her career to act on her values around nurturing and supporting her children is far more successful than the CEO who earns millions but completely neglects his values around being there for his kids. Albert Einstein put it this way: try not to become a man of success, but rather try to become a man of value. And Helen Keller put it like this: I long to accomplish a great and noble task, but it is my chief duty to accomplish small tasks as if they were great and noble. So next time your mind is beating you up for not being successful enough, try saying, "Thanks, mind," and then ask yourself, what tiny little thing can I do right now that's consistent with my values? Then do it. Instant success. Journey and destination. We can now list another right rule for the confidence game. Rule 6, true success is living by your values. Playing by this rule doesn't mean we give up on our goals. It means we use our values to set our goals and to sustain us as we move toward them. I often hear people say it's the journey that counts, not the destination, but I don't agree. The destination is important. A journey from New York to Paris is not the same as a journey from New York to Shanghai. The point is this: all you have in any moment is the journey itself, because the instant you actually reach your destination, it is, by definition, no longer your destination. The moment you reach Paris, you're in Paris. And then a split second later, you're on a new journey with a new destination, such as the hotel you're staying at. So why not appreciate every moment of the journey rather than focusing solely on the destination? You may be more familiar with this concept in terms of process and outcome. Process is the way you go about doing something. Outcomes are the results of what you've done. If you want to develop genuine confidence, perform at your peak, and find maximal fulfillment in what you do, you need to commit to the process, engaging in it fully and detaching from the outcome. Again, that doesn't mean giving up on the goal. It simply means shifting the emphasis. Instead of obsessing about the outcome, you get passionate about the process, about getting the most out of it, and doing it to the best of your ability. One of my clients, Ginny, was learning to paint, but she didn't enjoy it very much because she spent the whole time fretting about what the finished painting would look like, obsessing about the outcome. So I asked her what she could get out of the process, even if the finished result wasn't what she wanted. Ginny identified that she could learn how to use color, tone, light, and composition, and how to create different textures with the paintbrush. Next, I asked her what values she wanted to act on in every moment of painting. She identified learning and being creative. Finally, I asked her to go back to her painting and get passionate about the process, to embrace it as an opportunity for learning new skills and being creative. Ginny soon found that the more she engaged in the process and detached from the outcome, the more rewarding the experience was. Soon she was able to enjoy the painting without getting hung up on the end result. And, paradoxically, her paintings turned out much better. So, here's another rule for the confidence game. Rule 7, don't obsess about the outcome. Get passionate about the process. A Tale of Two Mountain Climbers. Hank and Jake are both passionate mountain climbers, both equally skilled, but they have very different attitudes to climbing. Hank is totally goal-focused. All that matters to him is reaching the top of the mountain in the shortest possible time. Every step of the way, all he cares about is reaching the summit. He is so intent on getting to the top, he can hardly bear to stop and take a rest. And when he does force himself to take a break, all he can think about is that ticking clock and how much farther there is still to go. As he climbs, there is little joy or satisfaction in the process. He is constantly pressuring himself to get to the top, all too aware that he's still not there. When he finally reaches the summit, he is delighted. He has done it. Woohoo! A moment of crowning glory. For one brief instant, while he takes in the view, the pressure is off. But it doesn't last long. The moment he sets off back down, once again his goal dominates all else. All that matters is to get there as fast as possible. In stark contrast, Jake's approach to climbing the mountain is values-focused. He has the same goal as Hank, to reach the peak in a good time. However, he is much more in touch with the values underlying his goal, developing his skills, appreciating nature, acting courageously, challenging himself, exercising his body, exploring and adventuring. As he climbs, he savors every moment of the ascent. He is not constantly thinking about the summit and pressuring himself to get there. He is living in the present moment, totally engaged in what he is doing. Regardless of where he is on the mountain, bottom, middle, or top, he is mindfully acting on his values. When he stops for a rest, he takes in the view and appreciates how far he has come. When he reaches the top, he is exhilarated. The view is breathtaking. And whether he is going upward or back down, he savors every bit of the journey. Now, suppose the weather turns nasty and they can't make it to the top of the mountain. They have to turn back. Both climbers are disappointed they failed to achieve their goal. But Jake handles it much better than Hank. Why? Because Jake has found the climb fulfilling in itself. He got to develop and apply his skills, to explore and be adventurous, to challenge himself and to appreciate nature. So even though it didn't turn out the way he wished, Jake regards it as a successful and rewarding outing. Hank, in contrast, is eaten up with disappointment and regards the outing as a failure. Why? Because he didn't achieve his goal. All he can think about is when he can come back and try again. This is the difference between the values-focused life and the goal-focused life. Jake gets to achieve his goals and appreciate every step along the way, and even if he doesn't achieve his goals, he still gets huge satisfaction from living by his values. By contrast, Hank lives in a state of self-imposed pressure and chronic frustration. It's all about the goals, and there's no satisfaction unless he achieves them. And even if he does achieve those goals, he experiences only a brief moment of joy, and then it's back to the pressure and frustration. For sure, some people do manage to achieve a lot with this extreme focus on goals, but the costs are usually huge in terms of stress, dissatisfaction, and ultimately psychological burnout or physical ill health. Values are wonderful things. They don't just provide a means for instant success, they also behave like a sort of... Chapter 13, Magic Glue. Does the name Tiktaalik mean anything to you? No, it's not a character from The Lord of the Rings. Tiktaalik is a prehistoric fish, one that lived 375 million years ago. The word means large freshwater fish in the language of the Inuit people who inhabit the Nunavut territory of the Arctic, which is precisely where Neil Shubin and his colleagues discovered their ancient fossil. And when they announced their discovery in April 2006, it made world headlines. You see, Tiktaalik has a flat head with very sharp teeth, rather like the head of a crocodile. It also has scales and fins, rather like a fish, and yet it is neither a reptile nor a fish. Shubin had discovered a so-called missing link, a creature that represented an intermediate evolutionary stage between fish and reptiles. Now, whether or not you believe in evolution or give a damn about fossil hunting, you have to admire Shubin's persistence. He and his team had to make no fewer than 4 Arctic expeditions over 6 years to find this fossil, spending day after day, week after week, searching through frozen soil in the desolate vastness of Ellesmere Island, a task arguably harder than searching for the proverbial needle in the haystack. I read about Shubin's adventures in his fascinating book, Your Inner Fish, and was particularly intrigued by his early experiences in fossil hunting. His first expedition as a total novice was in the Arizona desert. They were looking for tiny fossils, each no more than a few centimeters in length. Each day, Shubin would set off enthusiastically into the desert and eagerly inspect every rock he found for scraps of bone. And each day he would come back empty-handed, while the other paleontologists returned with bags full of bones. This went on for several weeks. Then Shubin had a bright idea. Instead of going solo, he would tag along with the team leader, Chuck Schaff. So each day thereafter, as they trawled the desert together, Shubin would pick Shaf's brain for useful tips. Unfortunately, while Shaf was incredibly cooperative and provided a veritable goldmine of information, it didn't seem to be of any help. Shubin found it all very embarrassing. He and Shaf would look at the same patch of desert floor, and Shubin would see nothing but rocks and sand, whereas Shaf would spot a wealth of tiny teeth, jaws, bones, and bits of skull. Shaf's recurring advice was to look for something different, something that had a different texture from that of rock, a different surface, a different form, a different way of glistening under the sun. Well, Shubin looked and looked for something different, but he didn't find it. His embarrassment grew ever stronger as day after day he came back with nothing, while Shaf returned with bags of fossils. Then one day, after many weeks of this, Shubin finally saw his first piece of tooth glinting in the sunlight. Resting on a pile of sandstone rubble, he could see it, clear as daylight. He had finally trained his eyes to do what he wanted. Now he could see the difference between rock and bone. He writes, "All of a sudden the desert floor exploded with bone. Where previously he could see nothing but rock, there were now tiny fossil fragments all over the place. It was as if he had donned a special new pair of glasses, and a spotlight was shining on all the different pieces of bone." From this day on, Shubin always came back loaded with fossils. Values as glue. Our values are like magic glue. They glue together the tiniest little actions to the biggest long-term goals. Shubin's values included exploring, curiosity, adventure, persistence, endurance, commitment, learning new skills, and challenging himself. Those values glued together every second of every day of every week, searching in vain for fossils in the desert. Day after day he failed to achieve his goal, but he lived by his values, and despite his embarrassment and disappointment, he had the satisfaction of doing something personally meaningful. And then one day he did achieve his goal. And even though it was just a tiny fragment of tooth, to Shubin it was as glorious as the biggest dinosaur in the halls of any museum. But it would never have happened without committed action. Only through serving his time, scouring the desert, could he develop those fossil hunter eyes. And the same values sustained him all the way from that first fragment of tooth in the Arizona desert to the discovery of Tiktaalik many years later. So let's now look at your life and see if we can mix up a batch of magic glue. For the exercises that follow, we're going to divide your life into four domains: love, work, play, and health. The love segment refers to all the time and effort you invest in your deepest relationships, with your children, parents, partner, and close friends and relatives. The play segment refers to all the time and effort you invest in rest and relaxation, hobbies, creativity, sports, and all forms of leisure, recreation, and entertainment. The work segment refers to all the time and effort you invest in paid work, unpaid work, such as volunteering or domestic duties, and studying, education, and apprenticeships. The health segment refers to all the time and effort you invest in looking after your physical, psychological, emotional, or spiritual health and well-being. These are arbitrary divisions, and I leave it to you to decide exactly what goes where. For example, if you're taking a course for fun rather than to enhance your career, you'd consider that play rather than work. If you earn your main income from playing football, you'd class that as work rather than play. Now, in order to find the glue in these domains, we'll need to do a bit of mind reading. The mind reading machine. I want you to imagine that I've invented an amazing device that enables you to read the mind of anybody on the planet. I hook you up to the machine and turn the dial. Suddenly a picture appears on the screen. It's an image of someone who is very important to you in the life domain of love. Just pause for a moment and conjure up an image of this person. Now, I pull a lever and suddenly you are reading this person's mind, and they just happen to be thinking about you. They are thinking about your character, about what sort of personal strengths and qualities you have, and what you mean to them, and the role you have played in their life. They are not thinking about all the goals you have achieved. They are thinking about the sort of person you are and what you stand for in life. And I'd like you now to imagine, if dreams could come true, then what would you love to hear this person thinking? Note, this is an exercise in imagination, a fantasy to help you uncover your values. You're not trying to realistically predict what this person would truly be thinking. You are fantasizing about what you'd love them to be thinking if magic could happen. So please, close your eyes or fix on a spot and take a couple of minutes to imagine this scenario. What would you love them to be thinking about you? Please, write down a few words about what you imagined. Now, choose someone else who is important to you in the life domain of work, and imagine a similar scenario to the one just described. They pop up on the screen and you tune in to their thoughts. They are thinking about what sort of character you have, what you mean to them, and the role you have played in their life. Once again, close your eyes, and for a couple of minutes, just fantasize. Imagine. If dreams could come true, what would you love to hear this person thinking about you? Now, write a few words about what you imagined. Choose a third person who is important to you in the life domain of play, and run through the exercise again. As you tune into their thoughts about what sort of character you have, what you mean to them, and the role you have played in their life, what would you love to hear them thinking? Now, write a few words about what you imagined. For this last part, there is a special attachment on the machine that allows you to hear what your own body is thinking. Yes, I know that sounds crazy, but this is an imaginative exercise, so anything can happen. Your body pops up on the screen, and you hear its thoughts about how you treat it, what you do for it, and how you look after it. If dreams could come true, what would you love to hear your body thinking? Now, write a few words about what you imagined. Tuning in to your heart. There are no right answers to the exercise above. It is there to help you discover what really matters to you about the sort of person you want to be. And if you didn't do it, notice how you're making a choice to avoid short-term discomfort rather than doing what will help you find long-term fulfillment. Don't beat yourself up about it. We all do this at times. Just notice it and learn from it. We often fail to realize just how much of our lives are organized around avoiding discomfort. And just consider, are you willing to go back and do it? It only takes 8 minutes in total, 4 times 2 minutes. When Cleo, the shy scientist, completed this exercise, she found the same values cropping up again and again. She wanted to be warm, open, genuine, supportive, and authentic. However, in social situations, she would all too often clam up